podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket at a damp Lord. Simon Mann's back from his holidays in the south of France. Look what you brought us. Disgusting weather.
Listen, I didn't see any of this. It was 2.5 weeks of unbroken sunshine. Well, apart from one thunderstorm. Could do with that sort of weather today. Really frustrating. But we all knew. Amazing the weather forecast these days, aren't they? We saw at least two days ago, categorically, no play on Wednesday. And that's what's transpired.
And even with the incredible drainage that Lords now has, you know, where at one point I mistakenly advised you that we might start play at 2:33 o'clock because there was a little gap in the weather. The ground staff had the covers off, they had the drying machines out, and the thing looked perfectly playable. And suddenly the heavens opened again. So obviously the plans were scuppered. But the drainage here is so good. Do you know, I remember being a test match here about 4 or 5 years ago. I think it was against the West Indies. And I was doing something in the real tennis court, which is out the back of the pavilion, just meeting some friends, and because it was raining. And there was basically, by the time I came out of the real tennis courts, the road behind the pavilion was a river. Really was. I mean, it's absolutely torrents washing down, like a sort of mini tsunami washing out the back of the pavilion. Within 45 minutes, we were playing again because the water just seeps through. And in a way, the drainage that they have here, which is obviously fantastic for getting play back on, is the reason why there's been less favourable pitches, perhaps, at Lords over the last year or two, because they just can't keep the water in the pitch anymore.
The remarkable thing was, when they put the drainage in initially, the pitches were really flat and superb for batting, weren't they? But gradually, over time, it seems, that, you know, that's not been the case, and it's become much harder to bat here, bowlers are favoured now.
And it doesn't come onto the bat quite as well. In fact, I chatted to Carl McDermott, the new head groundsman here at Lords, a couple of days ago, about the there's some nuances, really, of being a groundsman at Lords, and of course the slope, meaning that if you do actually try, you need to get moisture in a pitch to get it hard and get it true, because if you don't get enough moisture in, you can't do the rolling, the grass doesn't grow as well, and you don't get that rich texture of this top surface. And because of the slope, you actually put loads of water on it, it just all runs off. And in the past, that hasn't mattered so much, because the water still stayed roughly just below the surface because of the old drainage, but the new drainage, it just absolutely goes through like sand. So it's very hard. What Carl said is it's just very hard to keep a right amount of moisture in the pitch.
So what does that mean for this pitch that we're going to get for this test match? I mean, one thing I would say is, just because we've lost today's play doesn't mean to say we're not going to get an outright result in the game. I mean, it might be odds against, because there's a bit more poor weather to come according to the forecast. Yeah. So, you know, an even more truncated game. But, you know, it's still perfectly possible to get a game here done in 4 days. Well, there was one here that lasted only 2 days in a session, a couple of weeks ago. Mm. So just because we lost today doesn't mean to say that's it as far as results concerned. What about the pitch? What sort of pitch are we going to be expecting?
I'll tell you what sort of pitch we're going to be expecting. It's going to be damp on top and dry underneath, because that's kind of what it will be. Under covers for a day and a half, it will generate a little bit of moisture, the grass will grow a tiny bit, and it'll be dry underneath, because it always is dry underneath. Yeah. Now, even during the World Cup, when they tried to leave a lot of grass on the pitch, it was dry underneath, and it tended to sort of cut up and spin a bit towards the end. So, bizarrely, we could get a situation where on Saturday, say, or Friday, the third day of the game, having had this sort of monsoon today, it'll actually be like a kind of a desert by Saturday.
So what do you want to do then? You're absolutely desperate to win the toss, and hopefully there's something there for your bowlers.
Yes, but it will turn at the end.
But a shorter game might just sort of legislate against the spinner later on?
Yeah, possibly. The last day's forecast, Sunday, is good. So that probably will be the best day for batting, potentially, if there's a lot of interruptions.
Right. So what's your plan then?
You've got to bowl first.
Hope you roll the opposition out for 150.
Totally.
Stack up a decent score and try and make it almost like a three innings game.
Yeah, absolutely. You obviously had that kind of classic holiday where You took your family away for some lovely time in the south of France, and it sounds like you spent most of the time watching the Ashes. What sort of holiday maker are you?
I did. I watched two test matches. I watched the Ireland game, which is actually good for the holiday because it only lasted for 2 days in a session. That went down reasonably well, especially that quick denouement for Ireland on that third day. But, I mean, I'm afraid that the first Ashes test rather took more time up than we anticipated.
So the phrase for you is, you can take man out of the cricket, but you can't take cricket out of the man.
Unfortunately, yeah, there were a few adverse comments from those around me, notably my wife. But I mean,
what about the French, though? Do they? I mean, if you've got a hotel person, or I don't know, a person dropping off your groceries or something.
You
don't have cooks on your holiday.
No, only you have someone dropping off your groceries. I actually go to the supermarket to buy them myself.
Feeling the knife in my back there, or in my front, actually.
I thought it was a fantastic test match. I'm gripping for 3 days. England were playing with 10 men for 5 days. I think that definitely skewed the match. I mean, Justin Langer mentioned it, didn't he, in his sort of pre-match comments before Lords. And, you know, it's a massive... But if you take a Nathan Lyon out of Australia's team, or, you know, if Nathan Lyon had pulled a hamstring 10 minutes into the Edgbaston test match, then that would have had a massive bearing on the game. So ditto James Anderson. I know there's, you know, a lot of doom and gloom around England, you know, the fact they lost the game heavily by 250 runs, but they were playing with 10 people for 5 days, effectively. I mean, what other sport do you have where you're playing one person down? It doesn't happen in other sports. I mean, they didn't used to have substitutes in football. Now they have three, and sometimes four. You know,
rugby is virtually a different team.
Yeah, exactly. Half a team comes on. So, you know, I'm not saying there should be a change to cricket, but, you know, it does skew a game. I mean, the problem is with cricket, of course, is how do you, you know, ascertain that someone's definitely got the injury that they say they have got? Because, you know, for tactical reasons, you might want to bring someone in. You say, oh, yeah, he's got a bit of a problem.
I mean, of course, that person, if that person's injured, he can still participate in other ways. I mean, you get a substitute.
Well, if it's a bowler, you can't. It's a bowler.
If it's a bowler, you can't.
It's such a crucial person in a bowl. You know, your main bowler is injured.
I mean, you're not allowed a runner anymore, either.
You're not. And that does, of course, if you've got a top batsman who pulls a hamstring, then that does restrict the batsman. Of course, it does.
Jason Roy, would it? Just keep bunting it before.
But so it has a massive impact on the game, I think. And, you know, you can't make excuses afterwards. You know, England were heavily beaten. But, you know, it just reduced England's chances enormously. They weren't able to keep the pressure on that first day, nor in Australia's second innings as well. So, you know, what do we make of Edgbaston? England were right in that game. They had three winning positions, 122 for 8, 282 for 4. And, you know, minus 15 for 3.
You were writing notes while you were sitting in France as well.
Minus 15 for 3. You know, so they had their opportunities. And I think, you know, they weren't able to force them home. Anderson's loss was huge, had a huge impact on the game. Well played Australia, but they were only playing against 10 men for 5 days.
That's true. Well, 10 and a half men, because England
No, it wasn't.
They've got a fielder and a person who can bat. They've got 11 batsmen. I know what you're saying. Right, 10 and a quarter. 10 and a quarter men, then.
Well.
But anyway, that's splitting hairs, really.
10 and 1/20th.
Yeah, all right. It's splitting hairs, really. You don't rate Jimmy Anderson's batting, then?
No. Jimmy rates his own batting particularly highly.
So, if Anderson had still been playing, I would have still actually given Australia the marks for their better bowling attack, because they had a bit more pace and they've got Nathan Lyon. Shane Warne was on TV today saying he could see Nathan Lyon taking 700 test wickets. He could still play for another 4 or 5 years. And he does look like he's got so much energy and he's got so much skill. And he's an orthodox spinner, which is rather nice to see, actually, as well.
And confidence as well. He looks like a cricketer. Yeah, he believes in his game.
He said at the start of that last day, when he was asked how he felt and the responsibility of bowling England out, he said, oh, it's going to be fun. Yeah. You know, I'm really looking forward to it. You know, as opposed to Moeen Ali, who kind of almost does sort of shrink away from that potential responsibility when he's not confident.
I love Moeen as a cricketer. He's been fantastic to watch, taking wickets, you know, made runs, made exciting runs, made that brilliant 100 against Sri Lanka at Headingley, but they had to leave him out. He just looked like a cricketer, totally devoid of confidence. You know, he couldn't get his bowling going. He felt that affects his batting, and the failure in the batting affects his bowling. So it's sad to see. You don't like to see a cricketer that talented so low on confidence. True. But I just couldn't see how they could pick him for this test match.
No, I agree. And the other thing that I think was in Australia's favour was that they have the bowler of on the best bowler on both sides for me, Pat Cummins. Mm. I was standing behind the nets when Australia practiced on Monday this week, and there's something about Cummins' control and his understanding of what the batsmen like least, and his ability round and over the wicket, and this sort of, he just exudes menace, I think, and he was hitting the bat. This is just in practice against his mates, Australia. He was hitting the bat hard and going past the edge, and all the batsmen were struggling against him. And I just think he is someone who, he's going to get a lot of wickets in this series. And you felt that he's just given them that cutting edge. Obviously, England are hoping with Jofra Archer bringing him in that he's going to respond well to that sort of responsibility and give England a bit more sharpness, a bit more penetration. But the combination of Cummins and, I think, Hazelwood, I think, will be bowl well on this pitch. And obviously Siddle nagging away. I don't rate James Pattinson, actually.
Why not?
I don't know. I think there's something about him. He prances to the wicket a bit like a kind of a ballet dancer, and he swings a ball from his arm. And I know he's got, you know, he's got his tattoos and he's got his sort of stern look and his few sledges and things, but I don't know, I just think he's a bit of a charade, actually. And he does bowl the odd good ball, but he doesn't seem to be that consistent. He's a bit injury prone. I think he's a prima donna.
Oh, well, there we go. Well, so no Mitchell Stark so far in this season. It looks as though Hazelwood is coming in for Pattinson for Australia. Yeah. No Mitchell Stark so far in the series.
Or saving him up for
Old Trafford. So the fourth test.
Yeah. Well, even maybe Headingley, actually. He'd be good at Headingley, I reckon. Mm. You know, just a pitch with a bit less in it. You know, this sort of pitch and the one at Edgbaston, you need English-type bowlers who nag it around, nip it around, accurate. Stark gives you too many four balls, ideally, but he'll be definitely a threat somewhere.
What do you do as far as England's makeup? There's sort of rumours that Joe Denley was going to be left out for Sam Curran. We understand that's not the case. Denley's going to play. Of course, we didn't get to the toss, so England haven't named their team yet. Mm. Do you think there's a possibility when if it's a shortened game, they might say, well, actually, we'll go Curran instead of Leach? Or do you think, you mentioned it's very dry, do you feel that they'll go, you know, they'll stick with Leach because you need a spinner, because it is quite dry, and if you do have to bowl
easy.
Last...
It's not easy. I mean, what I do know is that Joe Root is a big fan of Sam Curran, just in his ability to change matches and his confidence in his aggressive approach, his positive approach, in his all-round skill, his energy levels, his optimism. I mean, he's an incredibly influential cricketer. So I think if it was me, I would actually play Sam Curran. He just
instead of Leach?
I think I would, actually.
So play five seamers and no spinner?
I think with a shortened game and probably interruptions on Friday and Saturday as well, I just think you want... A player like Curran can change a game in half an hour with bat or ball.
I have to say, you know, when I was watching from on my holiday, that evening when Curran came out and against Ireland, I think he made 37 off the top of my head. But the way he played, he took a chance. Because England were 130 ahead, and they eventually set them 180. And the difference was Curran, he played with such panache, such confidence. OK, you could say that the shot that got him out was not a great one. He holed out to deep mid-wicket. But there was something about him as a cricketer. He's only 21. I think he's one of the most interesting young cricketers in the world. What is he going to become? Is he going to become a batsman that bowls?
Yeah, more likely.
Is he going to be a genuine all-rounder? Is he not going to be quite good enough? I don't know.
I think height will prejudice against him being a really successful bowler. But I was here for the record-breaking crowd, one of the record-breaking crowd the other night here, Middlesex, Surrey, the T20 game. 28,000 people. It was an amazing atmosphere. And Curran came in a completely impossible cause, chasing over 200, 211, I think, Surrey needed a win, and they'd lost a couple of early wickets. And Middlesex had Toby Rowland-Jones, Tom Helm, Stephen Finn, bowling quick. You know, they had a decent attack, and he just put bat to ball straight away. He was completely unfazed, undaunted by the challenge, and played some absolutely fantastic shots. Got out in the end, but it just shows the confidence and the ability to. I think he came in number three, you know, and he has got the presence about him with the bat, definitely. So, you know, watch this space. We should just say, by the way, that tomorrow, the first day of this game now, because obviously the first day has been washed out, so tomorrow, Thursday, will be the first day, is going to be a special day for one man who's spent a lot of his career here from the age of about 14, Andrew Strauss. Of course, the ground is turning red, or at least some of it is. The spectators will try and wear red, those who know about it, and the advertising hoardings and various other elements around the ground will be bathed in red to remember Ruth Strauss, because it's the Ruth Strauss Foundation Day. It's a sort of launch day for this foundation, which is raising awareness for a rare form of lung cancer. And I thought it'd be just interesting to talk to Andrew about how the whole idea came about.
It stemmed from a conversation with Ruth for probably about a month before she died. You know, we were talking just about, I don't know, legacy, kind of, you know, how can we find something positive to come out of this situation? And, you know, I suppose, how can we, I suppose, use my platform to help others going through it? And so Ruth had to think about it, and she sort of jotted down a few notes on what she thought we should be trying to support. And she was very clear that it was about, you know, on the one hand, fighting these rare forms of lung cancer, which there's, you know, not a lot of knowledge there in terms of, you know, people associate lung cancer with smoking, and actually 10 to 15% of all lung cancers are non-smoking lung cancers. So there was that around understanding them better and finding a way of diagnosing them better and treating them better. And then also the thing that she was very passionate about was the support element for people who have terminal diagnosis, you know, trying to help people, I suppose, do death well and, you know, prepare them and their families for what's to come with the right sort of professional help before they go through it all, rather than just waiting for that horrible moment and then trying to sort of pick up the pieces from there. She was just magnificent through the whole thing and incredibly brave and courageous. And I think, you know, to actually even have the courage to talk about, you know, the fact that life is going on for us after she dies, and that she had to contend with her own mortality and still be thinking about, well, how can this help other people? You know, she was just incredible through that. And, you know, now that the foundation has come to life and it's got, you know, legs of its own, and Thursday is going to be the sort of, hopefully, the time that it starts to seep into people's consciousness. And, you know, from that, in terms of both awareness and funding, we can start doing some really special stuff, hopefully. Players are donating their shirts for the day. Owen Morgan's World Cup final shirt. We've got loads of signed prints of the World Cup winning moment. Net with Shane Warne. Tennis with Tim Henman. Like, all sorts of different things, really.
Not a net with you, then.
I am donating a number of different things.
Golf with Andrew Strauss.
Golf,
yeah.
Et cetera.
I'll warn listeners not to bother with a net with you, because your bowling is absolutely abysmal. What's your throwing like, though? Are your throwdowns any good?
Not really, no. Okay. No, that's why net with Shane Warne's a better option than with me.
Obviously, you played in Sydney when the Sydney Cricket Ground turned pink for Jane McGrath's foundation. How are you going to feel when Lord's turns red?
Well, it's going to be an incredibly emotional day. You know, I mean, we've obviously been working towards this moment for a long time now, and yeah, you know, the MCC and the ECB and so many other people throughout the cricketing world have just bent over backwards to make this happen. So, you know, I feel completely humbled by the fact that it's an Ashes Test match and we've got this day on day two of an Ashes Test. It's going to be emotional remembering Ruth. You know, there's going to be a number of things, you know, videos on the big screen and you know, Sky doing a big segment. So it's going to be a hard day to get through, no doubt about it. But I also know that Ruth would be incredibly proud of what we've done and incredibly excited about the idea of, you know, this idea in her head coming to life. It's going to be a special day for me and the family. The boys are going to be there and they've got roles to play as well. I just can't wait. I'm really looking forward to it.
So good luck to Andrew Strauss and his family for this fantastic campaign. You can go to the Ruth Strauss Foundation website and contribute or participate in any way that you like. And it's going to be an amazing experience, actually. Have you got anything red you're going to wear?
Well, I'm going to have to look through my drawers tonight to see what I've got. I think I've got an old Bristol City shirt. I don't think I can wear that to Lords, though, can I?
I don't have much in the way of red, but I went to TK Maxx today to see if I could find a red shirt, and all I could find was a bright red pair of Moschino trousers. So I decided not to buy those in the end because I just thought people would take the piss, basically. So,
well, it's no different from normal.
No, true, actually. But Michael Vaughan suggested a Manchester United kit,
right, okay.
Actually. So Bristol would qualify, I suppose.
Yeah, red shirts. But I'll have to look through my drawer and see what I've got. But yeah, it's a fantastical, deeply sad story.
It's a deeply sad story. And it's great that they're making something of it, actually. Yeah. Very much like the McGrath Day in Australia for Jay McGrath's foundation, which they do in Sydney every year and turns pink. And it's a fantastic thing that everybody buys into. Everyone feels great about it, actually.
Yeah.
It's been a weird day at Lords, hasn't it, actually? Because it's sort of... Everybody's been behind the stands, but actually it's been quite convivial and lots of conversations going on and old friends meeting. That in a way is what the Lord's Test is all about. It's the social side as much as it is the playing side, and there's been lots of great conversations. I found one story today. It was told by somebody that the MCC have had so many requests for people, members, etc., wanting to scatter their in-laws or relatives' ashes in the gardens, either on the main square or in the gardens at the back. They've had to stop it. They've had to prevent anybody bringing ashes in anymore. But someone's got round it today. I heard someone today brought a pork pie in with his father's ashes hidden inside it and scattered those in the Harris Gardens. So hopefully nobody actually picked up a bit of it and ate it.
Hold on a second. So when you come into the ground, everyone gets searched. People don't search you for people's ashes.
Well, apparently they do now.
Do they?
You bring the ashes in a tin or something. And go, well, what's in that tin then?
Right, okay.
So you could say it's a bit of sort of covering for your salad, I suppose. Could you? Sesame seeds.
Ingenious. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that myself, but there we go. Right, before we leave you... We're actually going to hear from some of your book in a moment, but before we leave you, we've had 6 days of the series. Do you think England are done in this series? Is it too easy, too early to write England off?
Well, obviously you can't write them off, but history says, firstly, it's very hard to come back from one down in the Ashes, and secondly, I just think Australia are better. They've focused more, they've got more armoury with the ball, they've got one batsman who is outstanding. We haven't even mentioned Steve Smith today and how to get him out. Hopefully England will come up with a plan before he gets 140.
Hoping he's going to go out for naught, because Tuffers has promised to parade down St John's Wood High Street naked if he gets out for naught. Yeah. Not because I want to see Tuffers naked, but I just think it would be funny to see him forced into it.
Amazing. God, well, that would be the whole... I hope the TV cameras are trained on Tuffers in the TMS box when Smith is on naught then, because he might have to start undressing, actually, at the point he's out. I mean, actually, Smith's only got something like 3 noughts in his career, so he's probably safe. But I just feel Australia have got more quality, actually, and they've prepared slightly better than England, who were obviously sidetracked by the World Cup.
Yeah, and of course, England have to win the series. Australia only have to draw it to retain the Ashes. Obviously, they've come here to win the series, but you want, first and foremost, you want to hold on to the Ashes, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's it for today. Hopefully the weather will be okay, more like south of France tomorrow at Lords. What we thought we'd leave you with today is, I mentioned before that I'd written this book, Cricket's Greatest Rivalry, The History of the Ashes in 12 Matches, and here's a little extract that I read out from the first time that the Australians ever beat England in a test match in England. It was at the Oval, 1882. It was the test match that created the Ashes. And we joined the action with Australia in their second innings, having engineered themselves a lead of about 75 with 4 wickets left. At 113 for 6, there was controversy. In partnership with Sammy Jones, Murdoch turned the slow medium steel for a run on the leg side. The throw was wayward and wicketkeeper Littleton had to move away from the stumps to collect it. He lobbed the ball to W.G. Grace, standing beside the wicket. Jones, who had easily made his ground, now wandered out of it to pat down a divot on the pitch, thinking the ball was dead. Grace, who had an intricate knowledge of the laws of the game, whipped off the bails and appealed. Umpire Bob Toms had no option but to give Jones out. Well, he could have said, "Is that a warning, Doctor?" or "Isn't that appeal a bit hasty?"
But clearly not being from the school of authority, he said, "If you claim it, sir, then out." He denied being this deferential afterwards. People usually do. But out Jones was. This was a good 94 years before Tony Gregg threw out the West Indian Alvin Kalacharan for wandering out of his ground at the end of the day. WG was a century ahead of his time. This was the first in a fruity list of diplomatic incidents that have spiced up the Ashes contests. The Australian captain Murdoch stood at the crease, steaming, but there was nothing he could do. There was no decision review system. And anyway, Grace was an enormous, imposing and hugely respected personality, practically deified. No one was going to challenge him, so the decision stood. Soon afterwards, Murdoch ran himself out. When Spofforth was bowled, Australia were all out for 122. England needed 85 to win. Time was not a factor. It was 3:15 on the second day, so there was still a possible day and a half left for play, weather permitting. And we joined the match with England chasing 85, slumping in the face of the demon Frederick Spofforth. 70 for 6 soon became 70 for 7 as Morris Reid was clean bowled second ball by a vicious Spofforth breakback. The demon had taken 6 of the 7 wickets to fall. The crowd stood in disbelief. Now Billy Barnes walked to the middle. There was still no stud, who was apparently strutting about in the dressing room with a blanket over his head. Barnes shuffled past Australia's Tommy Horan on his way to the wicket. "By Jove, Barnes, this is an exciting match," Horan chirped. "Yes, but you'll win," Barnes replied, barely able to get the resigned words out because his throat was so dry. It was still 15 to win. One spectator was so nervous he chewed pieces out of his umbrella handle. In the members' stand, people were heard declaring that the suspense would surely spoil their appetite for dinner. One man said, if only they would play with straight bats, they would surely get the runs. His female companion replied, really? Couldn't you get them some? Barnes, certainly no tail-ender, pushed Spofforth for 2, and then a fumble by wicketkeeper Blackham allowed 3 byes. 10 to win. If you happened to be at Edgbaston in 2005 or watching on TV as the Aussies' ninth wicket pair of Warne and Lee edged ever closer to their unlikely target, you'll have had some idea of what the atmosphere was like. It was what the modern player likes to call an arse twitcher. More drama. Lucas dragged the next ball from Spofforth, the first he had faced from the demon for 10 overs, into his stumps. His vigil was over. It had not been a productive one. From 55 balls faced, he'd managed just one single and a streaky-edged 4. That's a strike rate of 9.5. In a harsher era, the finger would have been pointed at him afterwards for his limp, inert performance, allowing the Australian bowlers to build intolerable pressure. I mean, 12 maidens in a row? It sounds more like a Jane Austen novel than a test match. But in the 1880s papers, the innings of Mr. Lucas, the Mr. in deference to his amateur status, was complimented for his exhibition of superb defence. Now, with the score 75 for 8 and still 10 to win, in came Charles Studd, the man who had already done the double that season. Surely he would be able to shepherd England home. Unfortunately for him and England, Lucas had been out to the last ball of the 54th over, so Studd was the non-striker. He watched helplessly as Barnes was caught off his glove from Boyle's nagging medium pace. The left-arm spinner Ted Peat was England's last man. He had no great pretensions as a batsman, a bit of a Monty Panesar, if truth be told, with a touch of Phil Tufnell Maverick thrown in. His orders were to survive the rest of the over, just 3 balls, to allow Studd the strike. He squirted his first ball for 2, past square leg. Spectators tossed their top hats in the air. 8 to win. Questions might have been asked afterwards as to why Studd agreed to the second run. Presumably he thought Peat had a better chance of holding out at the same end against the medium-paced Boyle rather than the demon Spofforth. Peat played and missed at the next ball. There were relieved gasps in the crowd, 7 or 8 deep cramming round the boundary. He had 1 more ball to negotiate. He flailed at it. He missed it. It bowled him. Many years later, the poet laureate John Masefield summed the moment up beautifully. Boyle took the ball, he turned, he ran, he bowled. All England's watching heart was stricken cold. Pete's whirling bat met nothing in its sweep. The ball put all his wickets in a heap. Australia had won by 7 runs. It was, of course, England's first defeat at home. They had lost their last 8 wickets for 26, and Spofforth had taken 7 for 44 from 28 successive overs with not so much as a drink or a pee break to give him an extraordinary 14 for 90 from 64 overs in the match. It must be considered one of the finest bowling performances in the history of the game and stood as the best Australian match figures for 90 years. The England batsman had played out 28 maidens of the 55 overs bowled, and Charles Studd hadn't faced a single ball. No wonder he deserted cricket soon after and became a missionary. There was a fairly disorderly invasion of the field, and Spofforth was chaired off by, one assumes, a bunch of Englishmen. Earl's Court hadn't been taken over by Australians then. The victorious 11 were cheered as neither they nor anyone else had ever been cheered, said the London Standard. Hats and umbrellas were waved in the air and the men were called for in front of the pavilion. Although Englishmen are naturally sorry that our 11 did not win, no one can grudge the Australians their victory. The drama was too much for the heart attack man, who fainted, was carted off into the pavilion with blood coming out of his mouth, and was soon pronounced dead. There was tentative conjecture in the England dressing room that Grace's action in running out Jones had galvanised Australia in general, and Spofforth in particular. Grace himself remained unrepentant. "Well, well," he said, "I left 6 men to get 30-odd runs and they couldn't do it." As usual, he had a point.
Sports Social Podcast Network.